Morning. I want to especially welcome our high school students. What community are you from? Good, you may rise. The students, still please stand. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with an award, national award-winning program called Courts with Class. The program is sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. Students across the state, from public, private, and home school, are invited to come and listen to an oral argument. They're given materials about the case so that they will know something about it, and they may engage in some activities in the school relating to the case. After the second oral argument, the students will meet with a justice of the court assigned that day to meet with the students and discuss the procedures the court uses to taking a case, hearing a case, deciding a case, and mandating opinions. The substantive issues involved in the case are not discussed. Anyone who wishes to attend that session with the students may do so, and indeed you're encouraged to come. Would anyone here like a summary of the case we are about to hear? If so, would you raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary. Seeing none, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. She is the justice assigned today to meet with the students. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. My immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is an empty chair. It is ordinarily occupied by Justice Patrick Crooks. He has been delayed coming to Madison and will participate in this case. He has agreed to listen to the oral argument and participate. Seated next to the empty chair is Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our first case, which is 2013 AP 197 CR, State versus Jesse L. Herman. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Herman is Pamela Mooreshead, Assistant State Public Defender. You have 25 minutes, Ms. Mooreshead. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Robert Prost. He has 30 minutes. And Ms. Mooreshead, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Pamela Mooreshead, and I represent the petitioner in this case, Jesse Herman. Judge Gonzalez said at the outset of this sentencing hearing that she could put her personal tragedy aside while she sentenced Mr. Herman. And there was no reason to doubt her sincerity when she said that. There's no reason to doubt that she believed that that was true. If that had been the end of it, we would not be here arguing about due process. But then Judge Gonzalez heard from 14 witnesses to the tragedy. And I really ask how a judge in her position could have remained neutral under all of the circumstances. There was such an uncanny similarity between the tragedy involving her sister and
Do we have to go that far, counsel? You said you can't imagine that a judge could remain neutral. But don't we just have to look to the appearance?
Yes. Okay. I think I was guilty of a little bit of rhetoric there.
What?
That was rhetoric, I think, on my part.
It was very nice, but I think what you mean to say is perhaps, and this is getting ahead of your argument, which you no doubt are going to quote the comments that come later, and I just wanted to make sure that we were all talking about the same standard.
And I think that we are.
What is the standard?
The standard, as recently reaffirmed in the Caperton case, is that, and it's been stated a number of different ways, but is that an appearance of bias violates due process when it reveals a serious risk of actual bias based on objective and reasonable perceptions.
Do we have to go to Caperton? Goodson, doesn't Goodson answer the same question?
We don't, and I do think that perhaps the reliance on Caperton and specifically my reliance on Caperton might have been a little bit overblown here, because really in Caperton what the court was saying was not that it was announcing some new rule about an objective standard. Really the only thing that was groundbreaking about Caperton was the application of that standard to campaign contributions, which was what got the commentators talking. That was the controversial point.
Well, I think, and I did notice the heavy reliance on Caperton, and one of the things that caught my attention about that was Justice Kennedy, when he wrote it, went out of his way, it seemed to me, to articulate that this is a one time only. This is a one in a million case. You know, prior to that, the U.S. Supreme Court had stayed out of the business of saying whether state Supreme Court justices had the appearance of bias. Chief Justice Roberts pointed out that, well, the author might think it's a one in a million, but they're opening the door to a lot more than that. So I appreciate your concession, given your heavy reliance on Caperton, that it's not necessary to go there. We can stick with Goodson.
Is Goodson different than Caperton?
I think that there is some daylight between the standard articulated in Goodson and the one articulated in Caperton, and, in fact, a difference between Goodson and Gudgeon. The standard that our Court of Appeals articulated in Gudgeon is very similar to the one that the court just reaffirmed in the Caperton case. The standard in Goodson goes so far as to say that there's a due process violation whenever the impartiality of the justice could reasonably be questioned, which I think does go a few steps further than Gudgeon went and than the precedent leading up to Caperton went. And I think that the court in Gudgeon, when the Court of Appeals did sort of the work of gathering up all of these cases and analyzing them and trying to find some kind of common thread among them, what the court in Gudgeon did was it reached essentially the same conclusion that Caperton has now reaffirmed.
I think the more comprehensive quote from Gibson, and you might be getting to this, but I think it bears reciting. The appearance of bias offends constitutional due process principles whenever a reasonable person, taking into consideration human psychological tendencies and weaknesses, concludes that the average judge could not be trusted to, in an interior quote, hold the balance nice, clear, and true under all the circumstances. Thus, the appearance of partiality constitutes objective bias when a reasonable person could question the court's impartiality based on the court's statements. And that seems to me to be what you're arguing here.
It is, and I think that the state agrees that that is the standard that applies here.
Let me focus in on that. So we have articulation of two standards. What I'll use for shorthand is the Caperton standard, and the other one, the Goodson standard. What do you see as the difference between the two? You said there was a difference, and how would you articulate that difference?
I think that the difference is that both Caperton and Gudgeon talk about an appearance of bias that carries with it a strong risk that there is actual bias involved in the case. The Goodson standard, which is more brief and just refers to an appearance of bias where the impartiality of the judge can reasonably be questioned, does not talk about or go that extra step and include a requirement that there be some risk, real risk here, substantial, strong, however you want to put it, that there was actual bias in the case.
And which one are you advocating today?
Your Honor, I think that the Gudgeon standard is consistent with what Caperton has just rearticulated. I know the state, in its brief, relied on the Goodson language, and I think that the Gudgeon standard is the correct one.
Let me follow on that, then. It seems to me that the Gudgeon-Caperton standard elevates the need of actual bias. In other words, that there is a substantial risk of actual bias and puts that into the equation of determining bias. That kind of elevation of actual bias seems to me to undermine a plethora of cases, including Goodson, including our own Supreme Court rules, that focus on the appearance of a biased judge or appearance of a judge being partial in a case, not impartial. So that's the, I mean, if you focus on the need for risk of actual bias, it seems to undermine, actually, not be consistent with, undermine the other cases that don't invoke that need and say a violation of due process can be met on the appearance of partiality vis-a-vis a reasonable person.
I think that is true. I think that it's at least clear that actual bias need not be shown, that something short of proof of actual bias is sufficient for a due process violation. There are two reasons why I've stuck with the Gudgeon standard. One is because I think it's consistent with what the Caperton Court is saying its precedents have led up to. And I did find one case that I think sort of illustrated the daylight between those two standards, and that was a case in the Seventh Circuit called Sue versus Pierce. And in that case, a judge had a professional acquaintance with some members of the victim's family. And the argument was that this created an appearance of bias that was a due process violation. And the court sort of walked the line in between those two standards and said, we don't have to show actual bias. An appearance of bias is enough, but it must carry with it some risk that there's actual bias involved. And in that case, the judge didn't know about the connection between himself and the victim's family.
I don't see that as light in between at all. I see that embracing the Caperton-Gudgeon standard. That is, that there is an appearance, but you require that the appearance rises to the level that it creates a substantial risk. Isn't that what that case is saying?
I think, actually, the language in that case was some risk. There must be some risk.
Oh, not a substantial. So the difference is between some risk and substantial risk that Caperton talks about.
And the only reason I bring up that case out of the Seventh Circuit is I think it illustrates a situation where arguably there could have been an appearance of bias. People looking at the situation could have perceived an appearance of bias. But, in fact, there was never any risk of bias in that case because the judge was unaware of the situation. And I think that's perhaps the justification for language like we see in Gudgeon and like we see in Caperton about there needing to be some kind of intolerable risk of bias.
I guess your responses to Justice Bradley caused me to wonder why you keep running to Caperton and Gudgeon. Gudgeon, of course, where the judge wrote on the bottom of the motion that had been filed on behalf of the prisoner no, or not probationary, I should say, no, I want the probation extended. Right, that's a pretty, seems to me, express declaration. Whereas the Goodson requires, it seems to me, and Justice Bradley and I may disagree on our reading of this, it seems to require something less. So I guess in short, why are you making things harder on yourself?
I have, and I stated this in my brief, I have no objection to the Goodson standard. I think it's a good standard. I think it's easier to follow. I think when we start measuring what risk is substantial enough, you know, that obviously that causes problems. It's an easy standard to follow. I think I'm making the point here that if the court wanted to use a slightly more stringent standard, the one in Gudgeon, the one that the Caperton court sort of repeats multiple times in different ways, that the facts of this case would meet that standard.
Okay. Thank you.
Could I ask, help me to understand, let's take hypothetically a judge like Judge Gonzalez, has the same background as Judge Gonzalez. What is necessary beyond that background to trigger this objective bias that you're advocating?
I think
she had said nothing at all.
Yeah, and if it had just been the judge saying, I have this in my background, we are not arguing that any time a judge has been touched by crime, you know, or has a family member who's been touched by crime, that the judge cannot sit on a criminal case, even one involving that crime. I think all of the cases contemplate a case-by-case examination of the facts. And in this case, we are not arguing that the mere fact that this judge said, I have this in my background, but I have zealously worked to set it aside and I believe that I can, would have created an appearance of bias. When it became a problem, it was later on in the hearing, where the judge started to say, first of all, felt compelled to talk about her personal story, despite the fact that she initially said she wasn't going to do that, to talk about it and through it to really relate to the victims in this case. And what I think is even more problematic than that is that it became clear that the judge wasn't going to try to set it aside, that the judge had really lost sight of the necessity of setting it aside. And, in fact, the judge embraced it, her personal history, and went so far as to say that it was perhaps the reason why she was sitting on this case. And it made her the best judge to sit on this case because she could understand and feel these victims' pain the way no other judge could. So not only did it certainly start to appear that the judge couldn't leave her personal history out of it, it appeared that she had no intention of doing that. And that was a problem. The court in Caperton, and I'm going back to Caperton again, but only because there's good language there in this instance. The court in Caperton said what happened in this case is really the reason why objective standards are necessary. It's for a judge who does not realize that there's a bias at work influencing her thinking in a case. It's for the judge who doesn't know. In Caperton, the court was not saying that the justice in that case had some kind of evil motive and was, you know, sitting on a case in which he knew himself to be biased. The court took him at his word that he didn't believe he had a bias. But the court said that subjective inquiry on the part of the judge is not enough, that there needs to be an objective inquiry. And the court said the reasons for that are the difficulties of inquiring into actual bias and the fact that the inquiry is often a private one simply underscore the need for objective rules. Otherwise, there may be no adequate protection against a judge who simply misreads or misapprehends the real motives at work in deciding the case. The judge's own inquiry into bias, then, is not one that the law can easily superintend or review. And that was, according to the Caperton Court, the very reason why we need the subjective standard for a situation like this one.
Well, yes. Suppose a judge has this background, really doesn't say anything, but it's a rather sensational case in which she's called upon to impose a sentence. And let's say the La Crosse Tribune does a big story about the defendant and how similar the defendant's case was to Judge Gonzalez's sister's case. Holy cow. What about that?
Well, obviously there's a continuum between no bias, the appearance of bias, and proof of actual bias, and we're sort of moving along the continuum. If the judge had simply made everyone aware that she had this in her background, but then more facts had come out regarding the similarity between these two cases, which is striking, would there have been a potential for an argument, a due process argument? I think there would have been. I think it certainly required more than this judge simply saying, this happened in my family 35 years ago. And in this case, we have, you know, not only that similarity and the fact that the judge talked about it, but the things that the judge said about how not a day has gone by when she hasn't thought about this tragedy, and about the pain that doesn't go away, talking to the victims about their shared pain, saying we, when she talked about the victims and the pain that we suffer as victims of this kind of crime. So, you know, the facts in this case go well beyond just the bare fact that she has this in her background and even well beyond the similarity between the two crimes.
So what you have to do is look at the whole sentencing record, if I understand you.
I think so, because in this case, you know, it looked as though everything was going along fine. You know, the judge made this statement at the outset. Everybody accepted that, and things were sort of proceeding in the normal way. And then all of a sudden, these statements happened. And they really, I mean, everybody here has experience with sentencings, either presiding over them or reading mountains of transcripts. Those statements really leap off the page when the court says them. Everything is very reasoned and measured and seems to be going along fine, and then that happens, and it's very, very striking because it becomes clear that the court really is thinking about her sister.
I'd like to just for a moment go back to the standard that you suggest be applied. Seems to me that's the most critical part of this case. Do you agree?
I do.
And on page 18 of your brief, and this is a due process case. It's not a charge against the judge about a violation of the code of ethics, right? Due process case.
Yes.
Okay. Due process is denied. This is the first full paragraph on page 18. And I'm going to ask the state to tell us whether the state agrees that defense counsel suggests, that this formulation encapsulates many different formulations. Due process is denied when there is an appearance of bias on the part of the judge that indicates a substantial risk of actual bias from the standpoint of a reasonable observer.
Yes.
That's, my understanding is that's the Goodson-Caperton test.
Gudgeon.
Pardon me?
Gudgeon-Caperton.
I'm sorry, Gudgeon. I didn't mean Goodson.
Yes.
The G's will hopelessly confuse me. Okay. Thank you.
I want to say something briefly about the nature of the sentencing proceeding and the way due process.
What was the maximum sentence the judge here could have given?
No, Your Honor, I do not know.
What was the sentence that the PSI or the state suggested?
The PSI recommended a 40-year initial confinement.
She gave less than that.
She did.
And what did the state recommend?
I believe that the state stood
a
silent on the
period of imprisonment.
Pardon me?
The state stood silent on the amount of time and recommended a lengthy incarceration.
All right. You had the PSI, the state was silent, and then the deceased. Is that significant?
Well, there was also, I do add that there was also an alternative PSI that was presented that had a recommendation of 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that significant in making a decision on this case?
No.
That's what I'm really pointing at. Okay, why not?
No, it isn't, because due process is concerned with the fairness of the process, not the fairness of the result. And the biased judge is sort of the axiomatic example of an error that would be a structural error. All of the cases that list structural errors list sort of as the ever-present example judicial bias. And, in fact, this court has listed judicial bias among structural errors in the Nelson case recently. That was the case involving the defendant's right to testify, the Carpru case, and the Travis case. The Court of Appeals in Gudgeon indicates that a due process violation of that type would be a structural error. So the question of whether the sentence would have been the same or different or higher or lower, but for the due process violation, doesn't come into it.
Justice Gableman.
Thank you. But in Gudgeon, the difference that strikes me is that in Gudgeon we have what a reasonable person would view as a declaration of intent that the judge before the motion hearing, after receiving only one party's motion, seems to decide the issue and put it in writing, and then somehow, I don't remember, that becomes a matter of common knowledge. And so one of the and I agree with the Chief Justice that the standard here is the most important part of this case, and it's difficult to articulate, and maybe we can't articulate it more than either Goodson or Gudgeon or Caperton have already. I think the closest that we can come to, I think right now, is Goodson. But do you see the distinction where we have in Gudgeon the declaration? And here, in the present case, we have a denial of a bias, and then we have statements that sort of implicate it. I guess the overarching question I have, because your red light is on, and I'll just ask you to think about it for your 5 minutes of rebuttal if you choose to address it, is how do we articulate a rule? Because, of course, this case is important, but all the subsequent cases like it are going to be very important. Is there a way that we can articulate a rule that will cover both and make allowance for both an express declaration of intent as well as what we have here, a denial of intent to rely upon the personal experience followed by statements that arguably could indicate that was not the case?
I have just one more question, and we're dealing with federal due process. You're not asking us to have a different standard for state due process, are you?
No.
So we're bound by what federal due process would be, at least in your argument.
Yes.
Thank you.
One other question.
Justice Prosser.
Does the test that this court adopts in this case apply to judge in all cases, civil, criminal, any kind of case?
Yes. That is, I can't see a distinction between, in any case where there's a due process interest at stake, the same rule would apply.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Probst, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Robert Probst, and I appear on behalf of the state in this matter. Your Honors, it is the state's contention that this case should be resolved with the finding that the comments at issue during the defendant's sentencing do not constitute objective bias.
Sir, would you please either slow down and or move your microphone?
Is that better?
Yes. Better. Yes.
Okay. Although presumed impartial, a sentencing judge is objectively biased if a reasonable person under all the circumstances could question her impartiality from her statements. Here, within her lengthy and otherwise unchallenged sentencing remarks, the sentencing judge briefly acknowledged the victim's statements by touching on her own family's experience with drunk driving. The state submits that the sentencing judge's speech is part of a larger conversation with the members of the community who were in attendance at Herman's sentencing. The comments echo those made previously and evince recognition and respect for those who spoke and whom were in attendance.
Counsel, there's been a lot of discussion. Do you want to
please
go? Okay. About Gudgeon and Caperton. I see this as a sentencing case. You have the gravity of the offense, character of the offender, need to protect the public. Galleon kind of helped us a little more, and Brown, I think, on adding some more meat to the bones as to the criteria that a trial court judge can and should go through. But largely, those criteria tether back to those three sentencing factors. When a judge makes comments like the ones here, what factors do those tether back to?
I think there are two distinct, I guess I'll start with this. There are multiple purposes in my mind to a sentencing hearing. And as I just referred to the comments at issue here, I think they're more of a speech than a sentence. And as I argued in my brief, you have this speech and these statements, and then you later have an exercise of discretion based upon acceptable factors as you've described them. So it is a sentencing case to the extent that we review the sentencing decisions made by the circuit court, the sentencing judge, for their consistency with acceptable factors by case law and state statute. And I think no one would argue that that wasn't done here.
Well, it's one thing to say you understand the victim's pain and acknowledge in court the impact this had on victims or the need to protect the public and how someone like this, who, you know, you go through, I get that. But when you, as a judge, make it about you instead of the people involved in the case, I'm wondering how that plays into the gravity of the offense, the character of the offender, and the need to protect the public. Because my understanding is you typically try to keep it, you may understand a lot of people's emotions and feelings and pain and things that go into a case. I've had a lot of heated sentences. But sometimes it may cross the line when a judge makes it about them instead of about that case. Now, help me through that distinction so we know the difference here and we can tell judges what's okay and what's not. Because there have been a lot of cases where people talk about religion. And depending on how you talk about religion, it may be okay. You have a lot of support networks and, you know, your people from your church were here and they've been helpful to you and they say they're going to be there for you. I mean, that may be a positive as to why a judge is imposing a particular sentence. On the other hand, if you said, because you have no religion and you don't go to church, that would be a reason to say the judge went too far and you can't impose the sentence the judge did. Do you see what I'm saying? I see this as a sentencing issue more than a bias issue. I mean, bias may play into that, but
The bottom line is the person deserves to be sentenced fairly and impartially.
Certainly.
And how do you know that this judge did that? Give me your best argument.
Well, the case you're describing is first, I think, and that's a case in which, during the exercise of sentencing discretion, the sentencing court made it explicitly known that it was relying on the fact that the defendant did not attend church regularly and was not a religious person. That's wrong because it punishes a person or defines the terms of the sentence on an unacceptable basis, namely the religion or absence of the defendant.
And that's here, kind of what I'm getting at here.
Sure.
How do you know this judge's sentence wasn't on an unacceptable basis? That is, was it a sentence based upon this specific crime, and was it properly tethered to those criteria? Or was this a sentence that really was inflated because of the judge's personal experience? That is a difference that kind of goes through the case law.
I think that a sentencing hearing has multiple purposes. And what you had here was, as is often the case at sentencing, and this was a crime that impacted a lot of people in the La Crosse community. I've set forth in the first part of my brief the facts of the crime, the number of people involved, the number of lives that had been affected. And so a lot of people spoke before the sentencing hearing, as they have the right to do under Chapter 950. Those comments are largely what I think the circuit court was echoing in response to them. I don't think that the sentencing decision was in any way tied to the comments that were made in response to earlier comments by victims and other witnesses. I don't see this as, I guess I see a strong distinction between the sentencing portion of this hearing and the speech that was made in response to victims' statements. And I think it would be a different matter entirely if the comments at issue here occurred during the exercise of sentencing. That is to say, like first, when the circuit court talked about these factors, if it sort of came up, and additionally, if it came up uninitiated by any other party, meaning if it was on the judge's mind clearly, no one else prompted it, and sort of out of the blue, she referenced this history. I think then we would have a different case, and then you might be able to challenge the exercise of sentencing discretion.
So as you see it, this is really the judge being properly responsive to the victims here speaking and saying, I feel your pain. She may not have been artful in all the words that she used, but that's your argument.
Yes. So if you think of it in a linear sense, a criminal case begins with the filing of a criminal complaint, where there was a plea in this case, not a trial. But it's not until sentencing that we sort of get to seek some closure. We get to sort of an end of the process. And that's the point at which we allow victims to make statements prior to sentencing. And then the judge, taking into consideration those statements, arguments by counsel, recommendations by the pre-sentence investigation report, and applicable case law and statutes, after all of that happens at the beginning of the sentencing hearing, we then say, okay, sentencing judge, it's now up to you to make a decision based upon all of that stuff and dispense justice. It is your job to determine justice, to determine what is a just sentence. It's the penalty phase of the end of the criminal process. I think it'd be a different matter entirely if the comments at issue here formed the basis for the defendant's sentence, or if they were part of the statements made by the circuit court when it was pronouncing sentence. But as I've said before, I think those comments were really directed to the audience, really a challenge to the community. There were a lot of people in the courtroom, a lot of people who had been harmed, a lot of people who have had, had a very real stake in the outcome. And I think the comments spoke to those concerns. They echoed them, but they did not form the basis of the defendant's sentence. And I think it would be, for me, the bright line is, if the comments came from the circuit court herself, meaning they weren't echoing earlier comments made by victims, and if they came during the exercise of sentencing discretion, that's where I would have a problem. That's where I would find some objection. The state's argument is not that comments that are objectionably improper later followed by a proper exercise of sentencing discretion necessarily whitewashes one. It's not that because the circuit court gave a proper sentence based on proper factors that we can just ignore everything else prior to. That's not the state's argument. The state's argument is that they don't occupy the same time, space, or purpose. And because of that fact, the defendant was sentenced based on proper factors, and any comments made by the sentencing judge prior to that exercise were for the purpose of challenging the community and echoing and evincing respect for those comments. For the fact.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
Please go ahead.
The two points that you I thought you were going to conclude with about a minute ago in response to Justice Eagler, you reiterated, or was a reiteration of the points that you started your response with. And that was that you could see this as a case of bias if the court had tied her statements in regard to her personal history to the sentencing factors. I'm paraphrasing, but I think that's the gist of it. First of all, do you have any authority for that?
I guess the argument I'm making is that there are multiple purposes to the sentencing hearing. And the test is the appearance of partiality constitutes...
Wait a minute. There are multiple purposes for a sentencing hearing.
Yes, sir.
The purpose of a sentencing hearing is to make sure that a fair and just sentence following the correct standards is handed down. What other purposes do you think there are?
Well, just as I said, in Chapter 950, victims have the right to speak at sentencing.
Of course they do, in order to inform the judge so that the judge may make a knowing decision.
Certainly.
Anyway, I don't want to quibble about that. I'm going to assume you don't have any authority for the proposition. I'm not aware of any. If you come up with some, please let me know.
Can I just ask to follow up, and then I'll let everyone else have their shot. What page starts, as far as you're considering this? Where does the sentencing start?
You're referring to the transcript of the sentencing procedure?
Okay. Right, because he's saying it's broken down into this part where you're talking to the victims and understanding them and hearing from them versus the sentencing.
I think if you look at page 81, the circuit court begins a discussion of the gravity of the offense and the character of the offender and then the need to protect the public. That would be where I think the exercise of sentence discretion occurs. And my argument is not that, you know, the comments have no relation whatsoever and no purpose, no proper purpose at a sentencing hearing. It's just that I think if the test is what a reasonable person would think, a reasonable person sitting in that courtroom, having heard all of the statements previously made, would understand that the judge's comments here were not the product, not just the product of her own experience. That they were not just a statement made for her own benefit, and I would strongly disagree with any characterization that she made the sentencing hearing about herself. I don't think that was the purpose. I would encourage the court to read the sentencing transcript in its entirety, and if you do that, I really think a reasonable person would understand that the circuit court was trying to challenge the community members there, trying to say this is the end for this case and for this person, but it's not the end for this problem.
Now, this is proof someone should never say it's their last question, because now maybe this is. So do you think from page 81, line 20, which I think is also 194 in the appellate record, from that point forward, the Galleon factors are discussed, referenced, fully set forth, sifted through, and the court reached its sentence based upon the things from page 81, line 20 on?
Yes. And I certainly understand it's not. And the test doesn't call for exactly a bright-line rule. It's not really possible, given the fact-specific and sort of nuance-based examination that we're asking this court to engage in. But I do think, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I don't think the comments at issue here are part of the sentencing determination. And I don't know exactly where that line is drawn, but I do know that a reasonable person sitting in that room, having heard what the victims had just said, having heard what the defendant had just said, would understand that the judge was speaking to them, that she was challenging the community, trying to, and I think she even said, you know, let's not pay lip service to this problem. I think that's the purpose for which those comments were made. And I think that given that fact and given a later proper exercise of sentencing discretion, it doesn't offend the defendant's due process rights. The defendant has a due process right to be sentenced on accurate information and to be sentenced by an impartial tribunal. I think that's very clear. But I think the defendant got that here. And the sentencing transcript reveals that. And a reasonable person would not have cause to question that. And I note, for example, in the sentencing, there was no objection made, no argument made about ineffective assistance of counsel in a post-conviction motion or on appeal. And I think that goes to show that the comments were not objectionable to people in the room. This sentencing didn't stop. It didn't halt. It didn't come to a point where everyone said, you know, let's pause for a second. And I think that matters. I think that that matters if the test is what a reasonable person would think about whether or not the judge is impartial.
I sort of hear your argument as a totality of the circumstances. You read the whole sentencing.
Yes.
And that you say, hey, is this sort of prefatory? Is it explaining potential problems? And if you have any objection, tell me. In fact, she does say that.
And I think that satisfies the subjective bias portion.
Right.
But that's not, we're not arguing that that somehow takes away any claim of objective bias later there.
No, I understand that. But you're arguing if you look at the whole thing, you can see a preparatory kind of discussion and then a discussion related to this defendant.
Right. I think you see a linkage between what the circuit court says and what the victims and other witnesses to the crime had said previously.
Okay. Because I think a drawing a line is a little hard to do because sentencing proceedings wander, covering a whole variety of things. Now, what I'm interested in is it seems to me that, and you haven't said anything about it, that there has to be a kind of test that we're going to apply, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the test can't be a bright line between prefatory and ultimate sentencing. I mean, that is not a bright line. So I want to know what your test is. The defendant says the test, as I understand her test, due process, and this is a due process case.
Yes.
Is denied when there is an appearance of bias on the part of the judge that indicates a substantial risk of actual bias from the standpoint of a reasonable observer. And as I understand this, it is derived from Gudgeon and Caperton. And Caperton is the last word from the United States Supreme Court on bias. Due process and
certainly,
bias.
Certainly, but it's not their first word.
No. It goes back to Toomey and a whole variety of cases, but it's the last word, okay? What is your test? Do you agree with the defendant? Due process is denied when there's an appearance of bias on the part of the judge that indicates a substantial risk of actual bias from the standpoint of a reasonable observer. Who's the reasonable observer in all these cases?
A reasonable observer is just a reasonable person, an objective person.
Yeah, it's the judge. It's the trial. It's the appellate court that's reviewing
putting
the trial court
issues.
Because we have to make up who the reasonable observer is, right?
Yes.
We don't have a poll. We don't have a test of a reasonable observer. So it's what the court thinks a reasonable observer looking at this, where the reasonable observer would say, or the reasonable observer would say, well,
yeah,
he got a fair trial.
And we begin with the presumption that a judge is impartial, and then we say, given that presumption,
right,
what would a reasonable person think?
All right.
And I guess
do you agree with this standard or not? And if not, what's the state standard?
The state standard is as articulated in Goodson. And the reason why I go with that
tell
standard.
Tell me where it is in your brief so I
will.
I know.
13.
I
agree with that standard, and the reason I agree with that standard.
You read it to me, would you please?
Sure. The appearance of bias offends constitutional due process principles, and this was the quote that Justice Gableman read earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever a reasonable person, taking into consideration human psychological tendencies and weaknesses, concludes that the average judge could not be trusted to hold the balance nice, clear, and true under all the circumstances. Thus, the appearance of partiality constitutes objective bias when a reasonable person could question the court's impartiality based on the court's statements. The reason I think that standard is the proper one is twofold. One is that that language employed by the Court of Appeals is not its own. It comes from Supreme Court precedent, United States Supreme Court precedent, going back nearly 100 years. And I think
tried and true, is that Toomey?
Yes. That's Toomey and In re Murchison, and with Roe versus Larkin to some extent.
Did and Caperton use that?
Caperton had a very similar statement. They probably more focused on Withrow versus Larkin than that.
It was a Wisconsin case originally.
I'm sorry?
That was a Wisconsin case, wasn't it?
Withrow versus Larkin?
Yeah.
It could be.
Okay.
I will take
go
your
ahead
word for it, sir. And I think that's the appropriate standard because I think that there's not really a great, you know, a three-part test or, you know, I know we like these nice rules, but they're not really possible given that we're looking at a test asking whether a reasonable person would find that the circuit court or the sentencing court in this case was biased.
What is the difference between, in your opinion, between the standard you like and the Caperton standard and the Gudgeon standard?
They're not truly inconsistent. I think that they use, and there are different Supreme Court cases cited. Withrow versus Larkin is predominantly cited in Caperton, but so is Toomey and so is in Ray Murchison. Mm-hmm. They're not truly inconsistent. I think both sides agree about that.
So if they're not truly inconsistent, then what difference does it make which one we deal with?
The difference for me would be that this test, as announced in Goodson and Gudgeon, has already been employed and is, I think, a clearer standard to use for circuit courts around this state. That's been the law for nearly 10 years now, and I think it provides a good framework to use. And as I mentioned earlier, it's based on previously existing United States Supreme case law. So I think the test and the language set forth therein is on solid ground.
I think.
And how do you apply that test?
How do I apply it?
Yeah, I
you start with the presumption that the judge is impartial, okay. And then you ask the question as articulated, which is whether or not a reasonable person,
reasonable person could question the court's impartiality,
yes,
based on the court's statements.
Right.
All right. So what would a reasonable person, wouldn't a reasonable person say, hey, we got a real problem here?
I don't think they would, and it was for the same reason I argued earlier, that a reasonable person sitting in this courtroom or the judge stepping into the shoes of a reasonable person would understand that the statements made are part of a conversation. They're part of they're echoing what victims had said, and they're not the product of the judge's own experiences. They involve the judge's own experiences, but they don't come out of nowhere. They don't arise from the judge's own mind. They come from comments made and statements made by victims and by witnesses to the crime. And in that circumstance, I think a reasonable person would say, and in addition, that reasonable person would see the circuit court later properly exercise her sentencing discretion. I think a reasonable person in that circumstance would not question the court's impartiality for that reason, because the comments are not the own judge's creation, because they don't occur when the sentencing occurs, and because they don't form the basis for the defendant's sentence.
I'll ask you the same question that was asked defense counsel. Defense counsel took the more difficult standard of a substantial risk of actual bias. And that's from the Caperton standard. And you're taking the lesser standard. Good question. Reasonable person could question the court's impartiality. Seems to me that more reasonable persons could question the court's impartiality than a reasonable observer indicating a substantial risk of actual bias.
Well, I'm looking at the Caperton decision itself. Yep. And as I said, it cites Toomey and Inouye Murchison and Withrow. The standard, as quoted in my brief, in defining these standards, the court has asked whether, under realistic appraisal of psychological tendencies and human weaknesses, the interest poses such a risk of actual bias or prejudgment that the practice must be forbidden if the guarantee of due process is to be adequately implemented. That's from Withrow. That formulation is not any different, and I think, you know, the questioning to opposing counsel revealed this. There's not truly any difference between that language and the language we use in Goodson, and the language that comes from Inouye Murchison and Toomey. Those are all different ways of asking the same question, which is whether or not a reasonable person would take issue with the court's statements, would take issue with the court's impartiality based on her statements.
And the reasonable person isn't a judge. It's
no.
A reasonable person.
Correct.
It's
asking this court, it's a question of law as to whether the judge is biased or not, and it's asking this court or an appellate court to put itself in the place of a reasonable person and then make a decision based on that.
Mm-hmm. But could I ask, I think you agreed with the Chief Justice about a totality of the circumstances test?
Yes.
The Goodson Court talks about question the court's impartiality based on the court's statements. I want to know, when you have a totality of the circumstances test and there are no court statements, when do you have objective bias?
Well, for example, in Caperton, there were no statements. That was a case that found objective bias based solely on the amount of campaign contributions. And so it's not a test that's simply applicable only if a sentencing judge says something, and then we get to evaluate those comments. In this particular case, the form of judicial bias advanced by opposing counsel is based on the statements, based on the effect those statements would have on a reasonable person. So I guess I can't speak to a case that did not involve that.
Well, suppose the judge hadn't said anything here, and it was well known in the community because about the sister.
Mm-hmm.
Would your test still apply? I mean, I think that's in effect just one of Justice Prosser's consequences.
I think the test would still apply, and I think that would be a worse outcome for everybody if. We encourage judges not to put these things on the record. This judge was very conscientious beginning the sentencing hearing by saying, I've made this known. And again, no one objected to this and no one raised any issue with it. I've made this known. This is what happened to me. I've made every effort to put this aside. It's been, 45 years since it occurred. But I want you to know that this happened. And then we move on.
Do you know if a defendant has the right to substitute? When this case first came in and was assigned to this judge, was a similar record made?
Not that I recall, Your Honor. I don't believe that this conversation or a discussion of the sentencing judge's background occurred until sentencing.
Counsel, I have a question, but before I ask it, it seems to me maybe Justice Prosser had a question, and I would defer to him if he still has that question. Or have you forgotten?
I will yield to the distinguished justice.
Okay. I disagree with you. And so, enlighten me. I disagree with you that there's no difference between the Caperton standard and the Goodson standard. Let me ask you, can there be a violation of due process when there is no actual bias?
There can be.
Sure. That's what we're talking about. It's what we're advancing here.
Yes.
It seems to me that the Goodson standard has actual bias as irrelevant. It doesn't matter if there's actual bias or not. There still can be a due process violation when there's an appearance of bias. Don't need actual bias.
Mm-hmm.
Caperton. That part of Caperton, which has been articulated as the standard, says something different. It doesn't say actual bias is irrelevant. It says there is a due process violation only when there is a substantial risk of actual bias. So to me, that's quite, not just no difference. It's to say it is an abyss would be an exaggeration. But it is a substantial difference, in my opinion. You see it differently. So convince me to your, respond to my view and tell me why and how it is totally in error.
Sure. So there are two forms of...
Well, don't be too eager to do that. Just kind of be gentle.
I'm not too eager. I'm just trying to answer the question. There are two forms of objective bias. One is when there are objective facts demonstrating that the judge actually treated the defendant unfairly. That's a form of objective bias that does require some proof of actual, that can rest on actual facts. Here we're talking about the other form of objective bias, which is based solely on the impression that one receives from
and
a
you don't need actual bias for that.
You don't, and you don't
so
need
then it. Why are you embracing a test that says there has to be a risk of substantial actual bias?
There has to be a risk of a perception. The perception is what matters here.
Oh, what matters are the words of the opinion, and the opinion doesn't insert the word a substantial risk of a perception of actual bias, does it? Maybe I'm wrong. Point, I could be wrong. Maybe I didn't read it clearly enough, but I don't think that's the words of the test. But I might be wrong on that.
The test, and I'll read it again, the appearance of bias offends constitutional due process principles, and I'm reading from Goodson, which is...
No, I'm talking about Caperton.
Yes.
Caperton. Because Goodson doesn't even mention the word actual bias. Does Caperton test have the perception of actual bias? Is that the word that's in it? That's the word you use. It may. I just don't recall it.
Are we from Caperton?
Was the risk. Yes, the risk of substantial bias, not the perception of the risk of substantial
bias. Yes, I agree. Okay. Under a realistic appraisal of psychological tendencies and human weaknesses, the interest poses such a risk of actual bias or prejudgment that the practice must be forbidden if the guarantee of due process is to be adequately implemented.
You know, counsel, about 29 minutes ago when you started, I'm just guessing, you mentioned that the court briefly touched upon the court's personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. The court started out by reciting the fact that in 1976 her family had suffered the tragedy of losing her sister to a drunk driver, and in fact was killed with several other young women. And then she assured Mr. Herman and Mr. Herman's counsel, and I guess everybody, that she, I think you said about 10 minutes ago, would attempt to keep that out of her mind. My recollection is she did not make a wavering statement. She made an affirmative statement that she would put it out of her mind.
Yes.
Now, in paragraph 11, and plus this also, my question also implicates the reasonable person who we're talking about. And as you know, judges are not the only people who are called upon to decide what a reasonable person would do under the same or similar circumstances. We ask the lay people who serve on juries to do it all the time. So at the 11th paragraph of the sentencing transcript, the judge says, in 1976, five young women got into a vehicle. Now this is talking about her sister. And only one of them survived. The two gentlemen in the other vehicle were 17, drunk out of their minds, and they did not survive. That was my personal story, and I will tell you that, I think there's a typo, it says that a day does not go by that I do not think of that personal tragedy. And I wish that I could tell these victims that the pain will one day disappear, but it doesn't. Time makes it less. We redirect ourselves to other things, and a day does go by when we don't think of our loved ones, and then we feel guilty at night because that happened. But life does go on, and I am very grateful today that the present matter wasn't worse. And she finishes up in paragraph 12 by saying, and so perhaps it is again destiny or a higher power, or she's addressing a pastor now, probably the prayers of many others that bring me to be the judge on this particular case, because I probably more than anyone else who would be able to sit on this bench in this county understand the pain that these victims are feeling. If you're Mr. Herman or a reasonable person, are you confident that the trial court is not allowing her personal experiences to bleed into the sentencing of this individual?
I am confident, and I'm confident because the two situations are very different, and I think the judge is honestly speaking to the people who had just spoken. I think that she was trying to say to the victims and to the witnesses and to the people present in the courtroom, the families, the community, this is a larger problem than just this case. This is a long-standing problem. It's drunk driving, in fact, is a scourge in our community, and it's been a problem going back for a long time. My case, her case, was specific. It had its own facts, different than the facts here. But unfortunately, sentencing a defendant for drunk driving is not an uncommon thing for a judge, and having an involvement with a family member who's had experience with drunk driving is not an uncommon thing. And that was what the Court of Appeals said, and I agree with the Court of Appeals.
The Court of Appeals also said it was a close case.
They did say it was a close case, and I respectfully disagree with that conclusion. And if my red light's on, may I finish answering the question?
You may.
Okay.
But the question was whether Mr. Herman would think that it was an unbiased judge. That's not the test. The test is not what the defendant would think. It's the test what a reasonable person
would. Well, that wasn't quite the question.
That is the test, Your Honor, and I was just trying to answer the question. And I don't think Mr. Herman would feel that way, because I think Mr. Herman would have sat there.
I didn't ask what Mr. Herman would feel. Nobody knows what Mr. I'm saying we put people in the position of judging what a reasonable person under the same or similar circumstances. You've answered the question as far as I'm concerned, and unless you have any thought to finish, I am done with my questioning.
You may.
I'm not.
Your
done.
Thought. Pardon me? Yes, just, well, okay. You let him do that, and then you can ask.
No, I've completed my answer. That's okay.
All right. Justice Presser.
I'm really concerned by what's at stake in these opinions. Opposing counsel said that the rule that comes out of this case is going to apply to all cases. You have said that that rule involves situations where a judge must withdraw, even though the judge isn't biased, because of perceptions that the judge might be biased, or whatever the language is in your test. I follow the language in your test. It seems to me we are empowering third parties to create the perceptions of judges. Let's say everyone in this audience is a reasonable, objective person. But if all they know about a judge is what they've been falsely told, that you're, I think what you're saying is all those people would say, that judge can't participate.
I'm not seeking to impose or articulate any standard that does not already exist. The standard that talks about objective bias and the possibility of a judge being too biased based solely upon her own statements or based on the perception of her statements is a test that is linked to United States Supreme Court precedent and precedent of the Court of Appeals here.
Yeah, but you conceded this doesn't have to involve any statements at all. You've conceded that the judge doesn't have to be biased, and that the determination doesn't have to be on statements.
Well, that there could be a case. I guess I'm not. In this particular case, I don't think the statements constitute objective bias. I guess I don't know. I can't address a hypothetical about another case. I do think the statements here don't constitute objective bias, and I do think that the test employed by the Court of Appeals doesn't broaden or expand the scope of what a judge must do to, beyond what already exists. I certainly take your point. I think the risk that a reasonable person could draw a conclusion about a judge without knowing all of the information is a problem. But that's why the test starts out with the presumption that a judge is impartial and includes a consideration of the entire circumstance, the totality of the circumstances, includes a review of the entire sentencing transcript, not just parsing individual words or individual statements. And so I certainly take your point that there was the possibility that a judge somewhere might have to recuse themselves or might be considered biased based on a determination made by a third party, a judge sitting in judgment later thereon, or a member of this court. That's a smaller risk, I guess, than what is necessary to implement the due process clause. And
isn't a reasonable person test under these circumstances someone who doesn't use false facts?
Yes, I think a reasonable person is an objective person. It's not a perfect person, but it is a reasonable person. And so I think taking into consideration all the information available to that person, this court is asking us.
Or should be available to him. This court is going to look at the whole circumstance in this sense, isn't it?
Yeah. The court should look at the entire sentencing transcript here. I think the facts of this case are confined primarily to the sentencing transcript because that's where the comments at issue were found.
Well, that so happens. In Caperton, it was amount of money that was involved.
Right, but but as I said in my brief, I think each case is very fact specific.
You know, but the standard should be the same.
The standard should be the same.
Is there actual bias because a reasonable person would perceive that a judge under these circumstances couldn't hold the balance true?
Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think a reasonable person sitting in this, the hypothetical reasonable person, and, you know, as an appellate lawyer, I'm guilty of this sometimes, it's too easy to forget about all the other people in the courtroom. We look at the transcript, we look at the notation, the individuals who are appearing for people, and we think that the statements being made in a transcript are sort of being made in isolation. And as I've said many times already, I think these statements were being addressed to the audience. I think they're being addressed to the community. And I think a person in that circumstance with that understanding would not find these statements to constitute objective bias. And therefore, Mr. Herman's sentence is proper. And if there are no other questions, I will sit down.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Ms. Moorehead?
I'd like to know right off the bat, should Judge Gonzalez have withdrawn from this case right from the beginning, never participate?
Maybe. And the reason I say that is I think that regardless of what we all say about the due process standard, the ethical rule does have a purely objective component. It requires a judge to determine whether there's an appearance of bias. And I don't doubt that this judge gave her own honest assessment of the situation. She was very forthcoming about it at the beginning of this hearing. She said that she had worked zealously, I think were her words, to set this tragedy aside. I don't think there's any reason to disbelieve her. I think it's easy to say in hindsight that perhaps looking at the ethical rules and a purely objective standard, that the judge probably would have been well to say, maybe I shouldn't be the judge doing the sentencing in this case. But
Counselor, opposing counsel's major argument was that when you read the sentencing transcript as a whole, you will see the judge was really responding to comments that had been made prior to the part of the transcript to which you object. And that once she was finished with that, she did move into the standard sentencing discretion discussion that we require of all circuit court judges. And so he said the comments were really a response to the crowd. What's your best argument that that's not what we should decide?
Well, I don't think that we can divide a sentencing hearing into sort of a town hall meeting portion and an actual sentencing portion. Certainly, there's a certain amount of speech making that sometimes happens at a sentencing. When this judge talked about, hey, we as a community need to do better to prevent this kind of tragedy, judges are moved to say that kind of thing, and if that had been all she had said, we wouldn't be arguing with that. But to say that, you know, that because the judge sort of made her comments in the speech making portion and then sort of flipped a switch and then started engaging in discretion, I don't think that we can draw a line like that. And as Justice Ziegler indicated, there is a huge difference between a judge saying to victims, I understand how this is for you. This is terrible. I understand that you're in a lot of pain. And saying to them, your pain is my pain. And this is the pain that we suffer when we lose our loved ones. It really was as if the judge sort of took off the cloak of neutrality and went and sat down with those victims. And I don't think that we can say that the judge then got up, put the cloak back on, flipped the switch, and exercised her discretion. And just by way of an analogy, if the judge, I think if we take it to an outrageous extreme, we can see that we can't do that. If the judge had said something about uttered some kind of racial slur during the speech-making part of this, we would never say that was a race.
That would not be a response to what was said, counsel. So, I mean, hypotheticals are great, but sometimes they kind of go over the edge, and I think that one's over the edge.
I don't think that we can say that because the judge was talking to the audience when she said those things, they don't matter. And we can't know anything or perceive anything about the judge based on what she's saying.
You know, years ago when I practiced, and it's been a very long time, we were always instructed, you never use the golden rule as an argument to the jury or you're going to get into big trouble with the court. And the golden rule was asking the jury to put itself in the shoes of the defendant, very literally in the shoes of the defendant. Is that what you're saying happened here, that this judge put on the shoes of the victim in her response, and so that's why we should say it was objective bias?
I would say that's part of why. Yes, she did do that. I think her use of the words we and our made that very clear. But there's more to it than that. The judge also indicated how very much this tragedy was on her mind, not only that day, but every day, when she said, not a day goes by when I don't think about it. So she indicated not only that she was stepping into their shoes, but that this was very much a factor that was weighing on her thoughts.
Counsel, if you say she was stepping into the shoes of the victim, aren't you saying that there was actual bias then?
This case reminds me a little bit of... Do you mind if I answer the red light again?
Yes, go ahead.
This case reminds me a little bit of Goodson that way, where the court in Goodson said, yes, we find an appearance of bias. We find that there's a due process violation. And, oh, by the way, we also find actual bias. I think it's a continuum, and I think that in this case what we have is sort of, I would say, strong circumstantial evidence that there was actual bias.
Counsel, do you agree with your opposing counsel that a judge, if there is a due process violation based on an appearance and only an appearance of bias, even if the judge is not actually biased, that due process requires withdrawal?
Yes.
Because you can't open the judge's mind and find actual bias.
That's right.
Comes from the appearance. It's just imputed.
Do you know at any point prior to sentencing if the judge brought this up and said, you know, heads up, I just want you to know I have this in my background and I want you to know about it? Do not know.
Yes.
Go ahead, Justice Prosser.
What did the defendant think the sentence should be?
I'm sorry?
What did the defendant think the sentence should be?
I don't think I can say to the extent that he's expressed opinions to me.
Okay, let me give you a hypothetical. I thought the sentence was 31 years of... actual complaint. I may be wrong. Let's suppose the defendant said, Your Honor, we recommend 18 years in prison, in actually confinement. And the sentencing judge said every single thing the same way and imposed a sentence of 18 years in prison. What would your argument be then?
Realistically, we wouldn't be here. This case would not be before you. But I think as a matter of due process, nothing has changed. It's the same. Because once again, due process is concerned with whether this was a fair proceeding, not with whether the result is fair. And it's particularly problematic in a sentencing situation where you could ask 10 different people what would be a fair sentence in this case and get 10 different answers. Sentencing is inherently subjective. It's something that a judge does that's more art than science. The sentencing decision occurs entirely in the judge's mind. We have really no review of sentencing for fairness. In the sentencing context, we review what goes into the decision, not the fairness of what comes out. And also because this is sort of a because it's a structural error situation, the argument that, hey, the sentence would have been the same anyway, or you can't prove that the sentence was different than it would have been if she hadn't been biased, that argument doesn't come into play here. So I think that it's particularly problematic to try to look inside a judge's mind and ask how was this sentencing affected by this. We can never know. There's no possible way to know.
No, the concept or the line, I feel your pain, has sort of become a joke. And that in order for a person and a trial judge to show an understanding of the real pain of the victim, which is what is being portrayed here and which can be used for sentencing purposes, right?
Yes.
The pain of the victim. That the judge has to say something that shows that this is not an abstract concept, but something that the judge knows, because if the judge said, I feel your pain to the victim, I don't think the victim would be very happy with that. And don't we have here an attempt to show that the judge feels the pain and is putting that into the equation?
I think it is possible that when the judge made the decision to speak about this, that she did that from that place. But
that's not relevant, is it?
No. And I would say that all of the statements taken together cross the line in terms of creating an appearance of bias.
By a reasonable person.
By a reasonable person. Because she didn't just say, I know how you feel because I've been through this myself. She did a lot more than that. She talked about feeling this pain every day. She talked about how she thought that this, her personal tragedy, had been the reason why she was called to be the judge in this case, because she could understand them better than anyone else could. And I think at that point, a reasonable person observing would say, she doesn't sound like a judge anymore. She doesn't sound like a neutral person.
Is there any showing in the record of how many other cases this judge has handled over her long career on sentencing a drunk driver?
No.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Moorshead, and thank you, Mr. Probst, for your arguments today on an issue we've had before, but not very recently, and most of the cases are Court of Appeals cases, or the United States Supreme Court, if I use the case. And that concludes our hearing in 2013 AP 197 CR, State v. Jesse L. Herman. The court will take a few moments recess so the high school students may leave, and we have another group of middle school students coming in. We are in recess for a few moments.